Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find the club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Dr. Haile DeBass, Executive Director of the University of California, San Francisco's Global Health Science, Chancellor and Dean Emeritus of the UCSF School of Medicine, and your moderator for today's program. It's now my pleasure to introduce today's distinguished speaker, Dr. Julio Frank, Dean and Professor at the Harvard University School of Public Health, who will be discussing healthcare in an era of pandemics. Let me tell you a bit about Dr. Frank. Dr. Frank is, as you will see, uniquely qualified to address the topic this afternoon. In January 2009, Dr. Julio Frank assumed the deanship of the Harvard School of Public Health. He is an eminent authority and a visionary leader in global health. He served as Minister of Health in Mexico from 2000 to 2006. He was the founding Director General of the National Institute of Public Health in Mexico, one of the leading institutions of health education and research in the developing world. As Minister of Health, he oversaw the design and implementation of a successful reform to achieve universal health insurance by covering more than 50 million uninsured Mexicans. He was executive director in charge of evidence and information for policy of the World Health Organization immediately before his country called him back to be the Minister of Health. When pandemic H1N1 swine flu broke out this spring, he was consulted widely by the Mexican government, the World Health Organization, and governments and organizations worldwide. Recently, he served in key advisory position at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and as president of the Carso Health Institute in Mexico. In September 2008, Dean Frank received the Clinton Global Citizen Award for changing, and I quote, the way practitioners and policymakers across the world think about health. Dr. Frank holds a medical degree from the Autonomous University of Mexico, as well as 3 advanced degrees from the University of Michigan, including PhD in medical organization and sociology. He is a member of the Institute of Medicine of the National Academy of Sciences. Please welcome my friend, Dean Julio Frank.
Good afternoon to everyone. It is really a pleasure to be here at this forum devoted to the promotion of open discussions around issues of public concern. I want to thank the Commonwealth Club of California for the invitation to address this distinguished audience and my good friend, Haile DeBass, for his very kind words of introduction. I've been asked to discuss the topic of healthcare reform in an era of pandemics, and I'd like to do that by addressing the need to develop a comprehensive concept of health security. This is a topic of utmost importance, the impact of the H1N1 pandemic on global security. This pandemic is clearly showing us that in health matters, the world has become a single neighborhood, and that the consequences of actions that take place far away show up literally at our doorsteps. But we need to place this awareness in a broader context, not the least because the current pandemic interestingly coincides in time with an intense debate on healthcare reform and also with the deepest global recession in decades. I will argue that a comprehensive concept of health security can help to better understand and meet the challenges posed by this unique moment in history. Let me start with the good news. It is encouraging to acknowledge that the first wave of the pandemic is basically under control and that the global health community has gathered enough information and experience from different parts of the world to reasonably confront the second wave. The development of this contingency, however, has had its share of surprises, and a sense of uneasiness still haunts the planet. This following flu season is going to be particularly stressful, says Tara Parker Pope in a recent New York Times report, and I quote, "Every sniffle and every cough is going to be scrutinized, awakening fears of the ominously named swine flu virus," end of quote. Since at least 2005, the world has been aware of the danger of an influenza pandemic, but we didn't know where and when it would start, and we knew practically nothing about the type of virus that would be involved. We were dealing with an expected but unknown event. People also understood that there was a limited number of things that health authorities could do to prevent such an event from happening, and that we had only a handful of measures at our disposal to control the immediate consequences of an outbreak. The population was worried but tolerant. As I argued in a New York Times op-ed published shortly after the pandemic began, considering the complexities of dealing with the first occurrence of a novel threat, the initial response was quite competent, although certainly not perfect. We now know a lot of things about the pandemic virus and how the second wave could evolve in the months to come. Let me mention some of the things we know. First, the H1N1 pandemic virus has become the dominant influenza strain almost everywhere. Second, there are no signs that this virus has mutated to a more virulent or lethal form. Three, most patients with pandemic influenza suffer a moderate illness, and the number of severe cases and deaths is still very small. Four, despite the administration of millions of treatment courses of antiviral drugs, oseltamivir remains effective, and very few pandemic viruses resistant to this drug have been detected. Five, while there are reasons to be optimistic, many people remain susceptible to the infection, so the impact of the pandemic could worsen in the second wave as a longer number of persons becomes infected. Six, pregnant women, obese individuals, people with asthma, cardiovascular disease, and diabetes, and the immunosuppressed are particularly vulnerable. Seven, the most urgent burden on health services is likely to be the increased number of patients with respiratory failure requiring intensive care, especially in developing nations. This demand could overwhelm intensive care units and disrupt the provision of hospital care for other diseases. And eighth and final, sanitary authorities have now licensed pandemic vaccines or vaccines against the pandemic virus in Australia, China, Hungary, and the U.S., soon to be followed by Japan and several European countries. The first doses are expected to be ready for use in the course of the month of October, but a critical challenge will be to secure access to the vaccine for all in need throughout the world. Now, the accumulation of knowledge about the H1N1 virus, its dissemination mechanisms, and the way to confront it has changed our perception of the influenza pandemic. During the coming fall and winter seasons, we will be facing an expected and known event. So contrary to the first wave, where it was expected but unknown, this is now expected and known. And this will change public expectations. The population is aware that health authorities can limit the dissemination of the infection through the use of the new vaccine and other public health measures, and that health services have at their disposal a reasonable arsenal of clinical devices to treat cases. So the population is now anxious and demanding. In a matter of months, we have moved from an environment of high public attention, low scientific certainty, and low social exigency to an environment of still high public attention, but now with relatively high scientific certainty and consequently very high social exigency. and that will lead to a situation where there will be little tolerance to mistakes or to missed opportunities to control the spread of this virus. Allow me to put this in a local perspective, using as an example my own country, which was the first one affected by this global pandemic. Like many other nations, Mexico had been preparing for an outbreak like this. The deadly 2003 epidemic of SARS and the 2005 outbreak of avian flu taught the world to expect that another microbial agent from animals would one day again infect humans. Over the past 6 years, Mexico bolstered its disease surveillance systems, built up public health laboratories, cooperated in developing international networks for information sharing, and devised response plans. Since the 1980s, Mexico had been strengthening its epidemiologic intelligence service in cooperation with the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC. Hundreds, literally hundreds, of Mexican doctors and other health professionals received advanced training in epidemiology. After 9/11 and the anthrax scare that followed a few months later in 2001, the Mexican health authorities also worked with their counterparts in the G7 to establish an instance that was called the Global Health Security Action Group, a tight communications network and coordinating mechanisms, which actually carried out simulation exercise exactly to deal with the kind of contingency that finally broke out in earlier this year. So when the news of the appearance of a new influenza virus in the Mexican territory broke out in late April, Mexico moved swiftly. Local authorities alerted international health agencies and introduced vigorous measures of social distancing. The president of the country himself led the response, underlining the seriousness of the situation. Fortunately, these measures rendered the expected results, and by the end of May, the influenza epidemic was under control. Despite the dire economic consequences of the control measures, most citizens approved the performance of the health authorities and considered the adopted measures as necessary. However, a certain level of social tension has remained, and media coverage will continue to be thorough as the population is expecting major public health efforts and the implementation in cases of disease of immediate and effective responses. The situation in other countries is similar, and the levels of anxiety will probably increase as the number of cases and deaths continues to rise in the Northern Hemisphere throughout the flu season that is just getting underway. SARS, bioterrorism, and influenza are largely responsible for the growing attention and resources being directed towards global health. Indeed, during the past few years, health has increasingly been recognized as a key element of global security and also of sustainable economic growth and democratic governance. So the health agenda has moved from the domain, exclusive domain of experts, to take center stage in the most pressing global issues of our times: global security, sustainable economic development, and democratic governance. In foreign policy terms, health has moved from the realm of low politics to that of high politics. Its relevance to health concerns has become so obvious that the term health security has recently gained currency. There is no doubt that investments in epidemiologic surveillance and response contribute to the control of threats facing nation states, such as pandemics and biological warfare. However, we need to go beyond the traditional conception of national security, the security of the nation state, and realize that investments in the protection of individuals from threats that endanger their health would also make the world a safer place. This idea lies at the core of the concept of human security as opposed to national security, which, according to the United Nations Development Program, includes economic, food, health, environmental, personal, community, and political security. Coined by the Palme Commission in 1982, the concept of human security has evolved through several phases to reach its present comprehensive content. A culminating point came with the work of the Commission on Human Security, established in 2001, which was co-chaired by Madame Sadako Ogata and Nobel laureate Amartya Sen. According to the report of this commission, human security, and I quote, means protecting people from critical and pervasive threats and situations, building on their strengths and aspirations. It also means creating systems that give people the building blocks of survival, dignity, and livelihood. The notion of health security, the health aspects of human security, brings together these two strands of thought by identifying the risks that challenge the health of individuals and populations. Until recently, this term has been identified with the protection against external threats. I believe that we should move beyond this limited usage and propose a comprehensive definition which may serve to anchor our efforts to improve global public health. Let me therefore suggest three main dimensions of health security. The first dimension can be called epidemiological security, and it comprises the more traditional definition of health security, since it refers to the protection against specific risks of disease or injury through biological and chemical agents, whether those microbes appear as a result of the natural evolution, like with H1N1, or as a result of a deliberate act of terrorism. It's very important, but in terms of the needs to prepare and respond, the measures are very, very similar. So that's the first dimension, what I would call epidemiological security. In contrast, the second dimension deals with personal services, and I would call it health care security. This was the usage introduced by President William Clinton in his health reform initiative of 1993, which, if you remember, was named precisely the Health Security Act. Addressing the Congress, President Clinton defined this dimension as follows, and I quote, "Security means that those who do not have health care will have it, and for those who have it, it will never be taken away," end of quote. So this is security of access, a very important aspect to know that if we get sick, we will be covered. However, I would suggest that we also need to include security regarding quality of care, specifically with regard to safety, patient safety from iatrogenic harm. You want a health system where you know that if you actually end up going to the doctor and having access, no harm is going to result from that. Second, effectiveness, that you will be treated with effective treatments. And very importantly, that you will have a responsive health system that respects the dignity of patients. So this is, again, part of this second dimension of healthcare security. And the third and final dimension is financial security, which refers to protection against the economic consequences of disease, especially against the risk of catastrophic expenditure as a result of paying for care. This is protection against the risk of going broke for getting sick. Now, it is interesting to note that these three dimensions of health security are consistent with the guiding principles of the healthcare reform initiative that, as we meet here, is being hotly debated in the U.S. Congress and indeed in the U.S. society. These principles include, first, protecting families from bankruptcy or debt because of healthcare costs. That's the concept of financial security. Second, improving patient safety and quality of care. That's healthcare security. And third, investing in prevention and wellness, which of course has a direct relationship to the public health measures that can protect the population from epidemics. The topic of security becomes particularly relevant given the critical situation that the world is going through right now. As I said before, we are in the midst of a unique coincidence of events. The best chance for health reform since the New Deal, the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression, and the appearance of a pandemic that conjures images of what has also been called the Great Influenza of 1918. Some of these historical landmarks are always called either the Great Something, the Great Depression, the Great Influenza, or the Big Something, or the New Something, the New Deal. So we have this confluence. I mean, it's really historically a unique moment. The highest likelihood there's ever been, we don't know if it will come to pass, for health reform, but coincided with this deep global recession and the appearance exactly at this moment of the influenza pandemic. When we were preparing for influenza, no one predicted that it would happen exactly to coincide with health, with a global recession and with a new administration that would push the health reform agenda as vigorously as the Obama administration is. Now, one could think that such an explosive mixture would make this the worst possible time to attempt something as ambitious as healthcare reform. But history teaches us that many of the most enlightened social protection measures in history have been crafted precisely at times of economic or political crisis, as exemplified here in the United States by the New Deal or by the birth of the National Health Service in Great Britain. The experience of my own country underscores this point. The financial meltdown of 1995 in Mexico created the conditions for excess mortality that was actually documented, excess mortality among children and the elderly, as well as for a huge increase in catastrophic expenditures among the uninsured poor. Partly in response to such evidence, Mexico introduced three major policy initiatives. First, conditional cash transfers that create incentives for poor families to invest in the human capital of their children through education, healthcare, and nutrition. Second, universal health insurance through a new public and voluntary scheme to provide access for 50 million previously uninsured persons. And third, the creation of a new public health agency charged with protecting the population against major health risks. Among other measures, these three policy innovations may explain why the economic crisis of 1995 was short-lived, and most importantly, why the three dimensions of health security have improved so much in Mexico during the past decade. The conclusion is clear. Guaranteeing health security becomes even more urgent in times of economic upheaval. Let us not forget that economic shocks are often short-term, but health shocks invariably leave enduring scars. So the excess mortality that has been documented in many economic crises, the people who die, the children who die, the elderly who die, they don't come back after the crisis has been superseded. So health scars are permanent while economic crises are transient. So when people say this is a time of economic recession, we should not attempt major health improvements, it's exactly the opposite. I would argue that this is the time to make the health system be most responsive. In fact, I would even argue further that if well-crafted, health reform can be itself a key ingredient of economic recovery. A major part of the rationale for fixing the U.S. health system has been precisely to prevent the major cause of business and family bankruptcy, which is, of course, paying for care, for health care. And indeed, a major rationale for the health reform has been to restore the competitive capacity of the American economy. What is at stake, though, is more than economics. It is also our entire ethical perspective for our globalized world. Indeed, our concern for global security must be grounded on a renewed ethic, the ethic of human rights, so that every human being may have the same opportunity to achieve his or full potential, as stated by the Commission on Human Security. The concept of health security brings together a human rights perspective with the imperative of human development. Through this comprehensive concept of security, improved health can contribute to the stability and prosperity of nations, which in turn nourish our global freedom from harm. I began my remarks by referring to the uneasiness that marks these times of crisis. I would like to end by invoking the wise words of Amartya Sen at the International Symposium on Human Security held in Tokyo in the year 2000. And I quote, "We live in a world that is not only full of dangers and threats, but also one where the nature of the adversities is better understood. The scientific advances are more firm, and economic and social assets that can counter these menaces are more extensive. Not only do we have more problems to face, we also have more opportunities to deal with them." End of quote. So let this keen awareness of challenges, tempered by the realistic optimism offered by current opportunities, inspire our efforts to move forward. The initial control of the influenza pandemic bought us time to tune up national and global surveillance systems, design risk communication campaigns, rebuild strategic reserves of drugs, and strengthen healthcare units. This is also the time to enact the structural reforms that will assure the long-term sustainability of the American health system, and in doing so, generate greater economic prosperity and enhance global security. In the words of President Obama, this is a future we should not fear, but with the help of scientific knowledge, work together to shape. Our generation has no task more urgent or important than to achieve comprehensive health security for all. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to Dr. Julio Frank, Dean and Professor of the Harvard University School of Public Health. It's time now for our audience question period, and we have a lot of questions. We don't have time to deal with all of them. I'll try to organize them in a way we might deal with them. Let me start by asking you. We hope we will not see a second wave of a more virulent form of the H1N1 swine flu this winter. But should we have one, how do you think it would influence the debate and the passage of the Health Reform Act in the United States? And there are a number of people here who want you to weigh in on the debate.
Shall we hear them, or you want me to answer first the question?
I think I can. Could you weigh in on the current healthcare debate in the U.S.? What do you believe should happen, and what will happen? Your crystal ball. Can you make a direct connection between possible spread of H1N1 or other viruses and the benefits of having universal health coverage?
These are excellent points, and exactly my purpose has been to connect those two themes. Now, one observation, I've been studying health reform efforts for the past 25 years, and it's very, very common in the debate about how to finance and improve the delivery and the access to personal health services to forget in many health reform discussions the question of the public health side of the health system. Public health is not outside of the personal care. It's part of a single health system. The best designed insurance reforms in the world have been accompanied actually by a decline or a neglect of the public health side, because you start putting more money, more attention, more political discussion goes around assuring access and financial protection, and we forget that the upstream interventions that can prevent problems are as key a part, or even more important, a part of the health system than the downstream interventions to treat once someone has become sick. A famous reform in another country, very imaginative health insurance reform with a lot of the topics that are now the center stage here in the United States. A few years later, immunization coverage had dropped in that country. So no matter how elegant the insurance side was designed, that could not be considered a successful reform. Immunizations was down. So I am very favorably impressed with the current proposal, particularly the 8 principles that President Obama has laid out, that actually prevention is very much a key part of the current reform efforts. So I think that's the way to do it. In the case of the reform that I was privileged to lead in Mexico, learning from that experience of other reform efforts of other countries that had neglected the public side, we actually, alongside the new insurance scheme, we built for the first time a protected fund, we call Fund for Community Health Services, which was meant exactly to finance preventive activities, early detection, a whole host of interventions where there's no spontaneous demand by the public. I mean, people tend not to generate demand for those services. And as a result, alongside the expansion of insurance to protect those who actually became sick and needed care, there was a huge improvement in some key indicators around early detection and other measures of prevention. So I think this is the United States is on the right track, and I would expect, I mean, I hope it doesn't happen. So far, there's no signs that the virus has mutated, but we cannot rule out that scenario. I mean, that's still, these are viruses that do mutate very vigorously, and it could mutate into a more deadly form. If that were to happen, I think it's all the more the reason to strengthen the healthcare system in a the health system in a comprehensive manner that addresses the question of the uninsured, the issues of access and quality for those who are already insured, but that does not neglect or forget the public health side of the health system. It's a comprehensive part. I would say it's the vital part. And a lot of what's going to make the expansion of insurance sustainable is to do the right investments on preventing disease in the first place.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker today is Dr. Julio Frank, Dean and Professor at the Harvard University School of Public Health, who is discussing healthcare in an era of pandemics. There are a number of questions which deal with the pandemic. And let me give you two of them together. Initial lack of coordinated global response to HIV highlights the dangers of inaction to prevent pandemic. How can we learn from the global response to the HIV pandemic in addressing emerging pandemics? And then slightly different, but on the same topic, with all of our technological sophistication, can you envision a pandemic similar to the plague of the early 20s, of the early 20th century in the 21st century?
There are many, many lessons from, certainly from HIV/AIDS, but if we look now, you know, at a quarter of a century of experience, we got to feel that this is still a crisis unfolding, but that the global response in the end has been very positive. I mean, just think about a new virus that appeared, that spread throughout the world, where there was no ready means of prevention or treatment. Suddenly, in the late 90s, we get antiretroviral treatment, but again, a huge problem of access for poor people around the world. Because health has now become not just important in itself, but also a key part of the development, security, and governance agenda around the world, this becomes a central topic of a larger set of discussions. For the first time in UN history, there's a special session of the General Assembly to discuss a public health threat, which was HIV, AIDS. And Secretary General Kofi Annan exhibits enormous leadership. We had Gro Brundtland as Director General of WHO. I had the privilege of working with her. And new instruments are put in place to face this global threat. And we have here today in the audience the first Executive Director of the Global Fund to fight AIDS, TB, and malaria, Sir Richard Feachem. That has to be one of the great success stories of international cooperation in any field, not just in health. At the end of the 90s, huge acrimonious debates on prices of drugs, living in a world where you had now a way of making this a manageable chronic disease rather than a death sentence, but most poor people in the world where the epidemic was increasingly concentrated had no way of paying for that. And we got through negotiation, through the use of diplomacy, the great inventiveness in designing new financial mechanisms like the Global Health, like the Global Fund, a situation today where there's 3 million very poor people who have access to treatment. Now, it's not over. I mean, there's still more people getting infected every year than go on treatment. But it does provide enormous positive examples of the value of international collaboration. And what was an incredibly acrimonious and confrontational debate, the world community found a way of getting together and actually devising solutions, and the solutions are there. I think we're for the first time can see, you know, the epidemic curve being possible to bend it in what has been by far the worst public health crisis in human history. So the main lesson I would take from the HIV pandemic, which is true, it is a pandemic, is that global cooperation is the key, and that mobilizing the instruments of diplomacy in the service of health can be an extremely powerful mechanism. This didn't happen with other outbreaks. It didn't happen with SARS. Many countries, there's a growing concept of epidemiological accountability. Many countries were not forthcoming in reporting. That has led to a number of much strengthened instruments. We have a new set of international health regulations that were to a large extent passed as a result of the negative experiences, particularly with SARS. And now I think the world community, the community of nation states, is much more subject to the vigilance of the rest of the international community to report events in time. And you know, Mexico did that, paid a huge economic price. I think we still need in the global governance some way of creating an incentive, not an incentive to prevent countries from hiding when outbreaks like this happen, because the economic consequences are enormous. Mexico decided to go forth and report with devastating effects on its tourism, billions of dollars lost, coincided with the global recession. It just came to compound those effects. So you know, there's a big temptation on the part of governments to not comply with international health regulations. And we do live in a world of sovereign nation states. So I think we do need, particularly for the poorer nations, the Mexican economy, which is the 12th largest economy, can withstand such shocks. But we need to create some mechanisms so that particularly very poor countries don't have the perverse incentive of not reporting in time for fear of the economic consequences of being forthcoming and transparent when it comes to these global threats, because then this creates a threat to everybody else. I think we still need those pieces, but by and large, we have made, I think, enormous progress in the last 15 years on the global health scene, and HIV/AIDS, I repeat, we're far from having fully resolved that, which is the worst public health crisis in human history, but we have shown that actually there are solutions. Financial flows for aid have increased, have tripled in the short period between 2000 and 2007, went from less than $7 billion to over $21 billion annually. So I think the world community has shown that it can mobilize. There's still much more to do, but I am optimistic that cooperation is the way forward.
Here are two related questions from the audience. What is the responsibility of pharma private sector in securing health security for the developing world, e.g. vaccine H1N1 for the global south? And a related question, is there a role for a private social enterprise initiative to improve access to care and develop pharmaceuticals in low-income countries?
The pharmaceutical industry has a huge role to play. And again, I think the AIDS experience shows that rather than the initial very confrontational climate, it was possible in the end to work out agreements that I think preserve two important values, and both are important. I mean, we need to preserve the incentives for innovation. So, you know, systematically violating intellectual property rights may provide short-term gains and, you know, politically spectacular results. But in the long term, it drowns the incentive to innovate. So we need to protect the incentives for innovation while at the same time assuring access. Because we don't want to live in a world where there are such huge differences in access that itself becomes a threat to economic development and to global security. The way to do it is, you know, innovative financing mechanisms. Those were pioneered by the Global Fund and the Global Alliance on Vaccines and Immunizations, things like advanced market commitments and other innovative forms of creating incentives for innovation and for pricing policies that make drugs and vaccines accessible. while at the same time creating a context of respect for the incentives to keep innovation as a driver for new solutions. And again, AIDS, I think, has shown that it is possible, that it's been possible to dramatically reduce the price of treatment and secure access for millions of very, very poor people, some of the poorest people in the world, to life-saving technologies. And that was, as I said, moving from an initial response that was highly polarized and confrontational. I think there's a lot of initiatives on social entrepreneurship. Of course, drug development and testing is a hugely complex endeavor that requires enormous capital investments. But there are many other activities in public health that can benefit from a bottom-up approach to sustainable economic development, including measures the whole host of measures, for example, to control H1N1 that are not exclusively driven by drugs or vaccines. And in general, I mean, public health has a wealth of other interventions that do not go through that, just basic sanitation measures or measures that tend to protect people from exposure to others. But I think in general that social entrepreneurship has shown through a number of examples around the world very promising results, as have innovating mechanisms for developing community-based programs, community-based interventions that deal with fundamental preventive strategies.
Two questions on universal coverage. A member of the audience says, I was raised in Canada where health care for all is considered a right. And I believe that's how you were successful in Mexico. Why do you think Americans are so afraid of single-payer universal access to quality care? They want you to give a political answer. Do you have suggestions on how we can get from where we are today to universal coverage? If we can't get it all at once, are there steps we can take that will ensure we get there in the end?
Well, there are two. The two questions are related, and one of my observations stems from the work of one of my colleagues at the Harvard School of Public Health, Professor Michael Reich, who has said or written that public policy is always supported by three pillars: a technical pillar, an ethical pillar, and a political pillar. And this is an engineering metaphor. So you need the three pillars to work in harmony to support the edifice of healthcare reform. The technical pillar is, just build, have the evidence, have good evidence on what's happening. Build into the reform proposals a component of evaluation, which I have seen absent in the current debate. I think a lot of fears of change would be reduced if from the outset the president or the leaders in Congress said, whatever we do, we're going to have a rigorous evaluation from the outset, not as an afterthought, not when things stop going the way we thought they were going to go. Now we're going to evaluate. But build that into the reform, a systematic evaluation of what's going on with an obligation to report back to the Congress every 6 months or 12 months on how the reform implementation is going on. So that's the technical pillar, but it works very well for the political pillar, political in the good sense of the word, as the art and science of achieving agreement on shared social objectives, because good technical formulations tend to generate good consensus. But a pillar that had been missing in the U.S. debate is the ethical pillar. And I think the American people have to discuss whether we should think of healthcare as one more element of the general system of rewards, or whether it is a right of people. Is it a merchandise, a privilege, or a right? The Canadians debated that many years ago and decided it's a right. In Mexico, the Constitution says it's a right. But this was a piece that was absent. And very often you got this dialogue among deaf people because there was not the previous debate as to the nature. Is access to healthcare just like any other system, any other component of the system of rewards? Just like some people drive a Rolls Royce and others go to work on a bicycle. They're both getting transportation, but it's fine. I mean, there's a system of rewards, and that's reflected on the distribution of rewards in a society. Or is healthcare, like education, a condition so that every other reward, the distribution of every other reward, is considered fair? This country decided very clearly that education is a right. Many, many, many decades ago, in the founding of this nation, it was established that every generation would start at the same starting line. And that's why you have public education in this country. It was clearly defined as a right. There was not, unlike every other industrialized country, a parallel discussion of the nature of healthcare. Until now, I was very positively impressed to hear in the president's address to Congress a couple of weeks ago, at the end, in this very dramatic moment of his speech, when he reads out loud a letter, posthumous letter, from the late Senator Edward Kennedy, a clear statement saying it is a right. And actually, polls show that the large majority of the American public thinks it is a right. If you agree on that, that's the ethical pillar, then you've reached agreement on the what. And then it's easier to discuss the how. But if you haven't reached agreement on the what, discussing the how, the instruments to achieve that vision, is impossible. Because you haven't really even gotten consensus on what's the nature of healthcare. Now, it is a case that, except for hypochondriacs, consuming healthcare itself does not generate satisfaction to anyone. I mean, we go to the doctor because it requires so we can work, we can study, we can learn. It is a condition, in my mind, for everything else. It's like education, and that makes it a right. That's the position that I think is the majority view, but I think that was the missing ingredient, and I think that ingredient is starting to be filled here. And now you will have the three pillars, a good technical solution, and an explicit ethical framework that says that this is a right, that, you know, if a child has leukemia, which today is curable, it's not his or her fault. It can't be part of the reward system, because most disease instances are not the result of the merits of an individual. They are the condition so that that individual can then do his or her best effort and contribute to society. And that fundamental ethical statement, which is what recognizing health as a right means, then opens up the avenue for agreeing on the how to. And I think finally that ingredient is present.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker today is Dr. Julio Frank, Dean and Professor at the Harvard University School of Public Health, who is discussing healthcare in an era of pandemics. I have a number of questions here related to the vaccine itself. How safe is the swine flu vaccine? Has it been tested enough? What should the policy be for testing vaccines? I'll give you.
I'm glad that question has been asked, because there's a lot of unnecessary anxiety. The vaccine obviously had to be developed quickly to be ready on time, but it is essentially the same vaccine as for seasonal flu. The technology to manufacture it is exactly the same. So, one of the negative sides of what otherwise can be very positive instruments like blogs and other instruments of internet is that there's a whole movement of nervousness around the vaccine, which may stop some people from actually taking it. And the truth is that there's every indication that it's a very safe vaccine. As I say, it's like the seasonal flu vaccine, same way of being produced. And we have, you know, now many years of experience with seasonal flu. There's going to be a very rigorous surveillance mechanism, but I don't think it's healthy to have people jumping to conclusions because, you know, there's an isolated incident. We need, I think, in this case, to be mindful of what the CDC, which is an extremely competent agency, says about the vaccine. But everything is clearly pointed that it is a very safe vaccine. The trials that have been carried out show great safety, and there's the fact that it is basically a very similar vaccine, just different antigens, but the vaccine itself is the same as the seasonal flu.
In the same strain, a recent study said that the regular flu vaccine could make people more susceptible to swine flu. Please comment.
There's no evidence about that right now, until now. There's no plausible biological mechanism by why that would be the case either. So I saw some of those reports. There's a lot of, you know, misinformation going on, just like with healthcare reform, by the way. So I think this is a case where I think good evidence is what we should be guiding our behavior on. I certainly plan to get my teenage daughter, who's in the risk group, immunized against H1N1 and seasonal flu.
Are seniors more susceptible to H1N1? Should they take any extra precautions? If so, what?
No, this is one of the instances where it's a great advantage to have been born before 1957, because those of us who were born before that year are actually proving to be less susceptible to H1N1, different from seasonal flu. Of course, with seasonal flu, senior citizens are more susceptible, as well as young children. But with H1N1, what happened is that was the same type that caused the 1918 pandemic, and that was the dominant type that was circulating worldwide until the pandemic we had in 1957 sort of displaced the H1N1, and it disappeared. It stopped circulating. So people born after 1957 haven't had exposure to that type of influenza virus. Now, the current one is novel, is different from that H1N1, but at least there was some potential cross-immunity because it was the same type of virus. So this is one case where, as I say, being born before 57 is actually provides some benefit.
There's hope for us.
Yes.
A mini-pandemic influenza has all the hallmarks of vitamin D-sensitive disease. Highest rate in winter, and group most affected have conditions or diseases associated with low vitamin D levels. Would you support an expert review of the evidence regarding vitamin D for prevention of this influenza with the goal of making a recommendation for this season?
Well, the interesting behavior of this H1N1 is that circulation has been maintained throughout the summer months in the Northern Hemisphere. Of course, it was much more severe this past few months in the Southern Hemisphere, which were then in their fall and winter season. But there's been ongoing circulation even in this period of time, which is a peculiarity. My position is that we should explore with rigorous scientifically derived evidence. So in answer to the question, yes, I do believe that scientifically derived evidence is the way to settle both claims and debates around any of these questions surrounding the current pandemic.
How well do you believe the media are reporting stories about swine flu and its consequences?
Well, I think at the beginning I was worried. Historically, next to the epidemic, in epidemics, not just pandemics, but any epidemic, when it's widespread and it affects lots of people. Next to the virus or bacteria that causes that epidemic comes a second epidemic, which is often more deadly, which is the epidemic of blaming, finger-pointing, stigmatization. And some parts of the media started doing that, and even, I would say, some national authorities took actions, you know, against people from Mexico, because that's where it started. We don't even know if that's where it started. That was where it was detected. And the world was very fortunate, I have to say, that the first cases, we hope these were really the first cases, happened in Mexico, which has a pretty well-developed surveillance system. But there were some expressions of this second epidemic that is the epidemic of stigma, and which we have seen with almost every big epidemic in human history, not excluding, of course, HIV/AIDS. But I think rapidly, as it spread throughout the world, that side has tended to abate a little bit. And I would say that the mainstream media, the serious media, has actually done a good job. I think it's going to be very important now to keep that, because obviously we're now going to go into a full-length flu season. It's likely that it's going to be longer than what happened in April and May, and it's going to last longer. So keeping the public well informed. I mean, we know that, again, as important as the vaccines and drugs, it's a good risk communication strategy. Communication is almost as important as any other thing we can do in dealing with an epidemic or a pandemic in this case. People tend to have distorted perceptions of risk, and so the media play a crucial role in keeping people informed about the real risks. I will never forget, as Minister of Health, when we had the anthrax scare, a reporter, you know, everyone was very worried. There were a few cases in the United States. There had been no cases, and anthrax is not a contagious disease. But, you know, it was very much in the media. People were nervous. And there was this reporter saying, you know, this is terrible. What are you doing about? And he was smoking a cigarette. And I said, why are you worried about anthrax? Stop smoking. That's really could save your life, but anthrax is not going to kill you. So, you know, we have very distorted perceptions of risk, we humans. I mean, that's part of our human nature. So good communication is essential to deal with any crisis, but particularly with epidemics.
If not swine flu, how likely is a pandemic of some kind within the next 5 years?
Well, I mean, we do live in a world where contacts and exchange and travel, I mean, you know, there's an intensity of human exchange, of microbial traffic, unprecedented in human history. That fact itself is not new. The first case of a transnational epidemic was the Athenian plague of the 4th century BC, which was directly tied to international trade. But what is different is the extent and depth of contacts. And we've seen a number of diseases emerging in the past few years, moving from animals to humans, and in that process recombining their genetic material and therefore potentially creating new strains. So, influenza is just one more of that sequence. I do think it's not another influenza, because those are more or less long cycles, but other diseases that go from animals to humans are very likely to continue appearing, and that's why it's so important, and I come back to the topic of health reform, to make good surveillance part of any effort to improve the health system. This is the invisible side of the health system. It's not the dramatic heart operation that saves a life immediately, but it's that part of the health system that you only notice when it fails. You know, we are not aware of all the outbreaks that didn't happen, because 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, there's literally an army of epidemiologists and public health professionals who are actually guarding our borders. This is a part of national security, except the invading armies are not other human beings, are microbes. And it only shows when it fails. So we need to keep investing on the public health side of the health system, and that way we'll be able to detect. We have many, many, much more powerful tools at our disposal, as Amartya Sen wrote, today than we've had ever in the past. But we need to have a good public health infrastructure.
To your knowledge, is the Pentagon including health threats, particularly infectious diseases, in its plans for national security in coming decades?
Well, I don't know specifically about the Pentagon, and I can't comment on that, but I know that increasingly and in a very public way, issues of health-related threats are increasingly being brought to the discussion around the security agenda, and they should be. It's, of course, the you know, specific threats like a new virus circulating throughout the world. But it's also, I mean, this is something we need to realize. It's also that when you live in a world where there are, you know, 10 million deaths of children from preventable diseases, even if it's not as dramatic as a new virus and a pandemic, but 10 million kids die every year from diseases that we can prevent, that creates a big sense of insecurity, because that's exactly the breeding ground for resentment, for, you know, extremist views of the world about the unfair nature of things that can lead some groups to extremist actions. So improving health way beyond just dealing with a acute crisis, making sure, you know, that we don't have 500,000 women every year that die in childbirth, 99% of which of those deaths happen in developing countries. That's also building a more secure world. It is something we should do, because human life is intrinsically valued. But in addition, it would make the world a more secure place if we can actually mobilize all the resources of science to finally deal with the many millions of deaths that are completely unnecessary. So I would say that it is a security issue beyond this acute crisis, and that's why investing in global health is probably one of the best investments that any country can make.
Unfortunately, we've reached a point in our program where there's time for only one last question. And here it is from the moderator. Dean Frank, what inspires a man who was a key advisor on global health to the two richest men in the world, Bill Gates in the United States and Carlos Slim in Mexico, to return to academia?
Well, I will tell you what inspires. In the many facets of my career, whether it's been at WHO or as Minister of Health of a developing country or in the world of philanthropy, the uniting theme, the theme that connects all of those positions, is my firm belief that science is the truly potent, powerful force we have to exact enlightened and purposeful change in the world. There are many other forces for change, you know, prejudice, exclusion, you know, extremisms of all kinds. But science is our one hope for humankind to actually create the conditions for purposeful social transformation that makes the world a better place. And in every one of those positions, that's been what I've done. I mean, I've tried to take scientific knowledge, convert it into evidence, to drive policies that can then make the world a better place. But that has been the motivation. And universities are the places where scientific knowledge gets created, gets produced. I think we need to continue to invest, because historical experience shows us that when we fail to invest in knowledge, then other explanatory frameworks that tend to blame people, to exclude people, to give way to prejudice or discrimination, those take over. Science is our best antidote against those forms, which also produce social change, but not enlightened social change. So I do believe in the mission of the university in producing the scientific foundation that is, as I say, the best instrument that human beings have invented to make the world a better place.
We're glad to have you back in academia. Our thanks to Dr. Julio Frank, Dean and Professor at Harvard University School of Public Health. We would also like to thank our audience here and on radio, television, and the internet. I'm Dr. Haile Dabbas, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion is adjourned.